Hey everyone, thanks for connecting with this message from Hurricane Community Church, where we're all about inviting people into a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to connect with us further, consider subscribing to our YouTube channel or following us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Most importantly, we hope that connecting with HCC will help you take next steps in connecting with God.
If you were asked to describe the person or persons that you thought were the most respectable, what types of qualities and traits and attributes would you discover in them? What would you list as the qualities, traits, or attributes that would be considered to be respectable? As I thought about that question, I did a little bit of research to see if I could find lists that listed the most respectable qualities. And what I found interesting is that I didn't find a lot of most respected lists, but what I found was most successful lists. I found lists that gave the qualities of a successful person. And what I found interesting about that is just because a person is successful doesn't necessarily mean that person is respected. In part two of the Better For It series, we uncovered a quality or an attribute or a trait that is really a respectable one for most people to carry and to have with them. It's a character trait or an attribute or a quality that is called respondability. And it is the ability to choose a thoughtful, heartfelt, wise response to a situation rather than simply react. This character trait is one that in some settings I do a really, really good job at. There are some settings in my life where I have the ability to sit back, to exhibit a tremendous amount of self-control and be thoughtful and heartfelt and wise in how I respond in a situation. Then there are other settings where I don't do as well. There are other settings where I'm a little bit more reactionary. I'm still probably just as heartfelt, but maybe not just as thoughtful and wise. And the problem with that in my life, and probably in many of your lives as well, is that reacting in a situation often serves to undermine the overall benefit and well-being of the situation and the relationships of those involved in the situation. Reacting, which is natural and almost involuntary sometimes, is almost always damaging in the context of relationships. Again, there are exceptions to that. There are times where reaction is an appropriate type of response. But in most scenarios, especially most relational settings, and especially in our relationship with God, reactionary decisions tend to undermine the well-being of the overall situation. Whereas respondability, responding to a situation, almost always serves the situation more effectively than reacting. Respondability is almost counterintuitive. It's almost unnatural. And so therefore, it always requires intentionality. It always requires effort on our part to respond rather than react. As part of part two, the Better For It series, we uncovered the story of a guy, or at least part of the story, of a guy named Joseph, who experienced a roller coaster of circumstances in life. And through all of them, through the highs and through the lows and through everything in between, Joseph chose the path of respondability. Excuse me. And this path of respondability was centered around a belief that Joseph had that God was with him, even when it seemed it wasn't. And as we wrapped up last week, or the last part of the Better For It series, we ended with a question. And that question is the same question that we're going to end this message with as well. And the question is, How would someone in your circumstances respond if they believed God was with them? This is something that we saw clearly in Joseph's life. And if you weren't here for part two and don't want to pause this to go back and watch part two before you watch this, let me kind of catch you up a little bit. Where we left Joseph's stories off, he had been kidnapped once, sold twice, falsely accused and framed for a crime he didn't commit, and then imprisoned for the crime he didn't commit because he didn't commit it and because he did the right thing. And so we pick up the story with Joseph as he is now put in prison, falsely accused, and now serving a sentence for a crime that he didn't commit. And in Genesis, the first book of the Bible, we pick up Joseph's story. But the Lord was with Joseph in the prison and showed him his faithful love. Now, Joseph is in prison, and things aren't going so well for Joseph. And in those kind of situations, we don't really describe them often as the ones where we believe God is showing us his faithful love. We tend to believe God is showing us his faithful love when things are going well for us, when life is kind of smooth sailing, when the challenges are minimal and the rewards are great. But Joseph had a perspective where God was with him in the midst of the challenges, no matter the circumstances. He was able to choose responsibility, and because he was able to choose to respond rather than react, Joseph experienced being able to be better for it, no matter what it is. The Hebrew word in which the book of Genesis would have originally been written in the Hebrew language, but the word that's used there for faithful love is what's known as a covenant word. And in the Jewish culture, a covenant is basically a legally binding agreement between two parties. And so Joseph was able to choose responsibility because he believed that he was in a covenant relationship with God. And in that covenant relationship, God, no matter the circumstance, would uphold his end of the relationship. And so in prison, Joseph finds that God is showing him his faithful love. And the writer of Hebrews, or the writer of Genesis, continues the story. And the Lord made Joseph a favorite with the prison warden. Now, I don't know about you, but we tend to believe that when God is with us, we don't find ourselves in a situation to become a favorite of the prison warden. We especially not having been wrongly and unjustly and unfairly accused of a crime we didn't commit and then being punished for it. But in this scenario, Joseph is a favorite of the prison warden. So much so that the prison warden puts Joseph in charge of everything in the prison. So things kind of, even in prison, tend to look up a little bit for Joseph. And I suppose if you have to be in prison, becoming a favorite of the prison warden wouldn't be a bad thing. Now, it probably caused some problems with a few of the other prisoners. But Joseph finds something positive happening in the midst of incredibly unfair and unjust circumstances. So, in seemingly unrelated events, the ruler of Egypt, who was known as Pharaoh, has a falling out with his baker and his butler. And he has both of them thrown into the very same prison that Joseph is in charge of. And one day, Joseph notices that the two are a little bit out of sorts. And so he asks kind of what's going on that has them so down. And both of them share that they have had dreams that have troubled them. They don't know what they mean, and no one can tell them what they mean. And so Joseph, in this moment, has an incredible response to the two of them in relationship to their dreams. Here's what he says to them. He says, interpreting dreams is God's business. Go ahead and tell me your dreams. Now, on the surface, some of us might think that this is Joseph putting himself in God's position. If interpreting dreams is God's business, and I tell you to go ahead and tell me your dreams, I would tell you that I have the ability of God to interpret your dreams. But that's not what Joseph is doing here. Instead, what Joseph is doing here is clearly communicating that no matter what the circumstances are, God is with him and God will work in him and work through him. And so Joseph is willing and available to interpret the dreams by these two men. So the butler tells Joseph about his dreams. He talks to him about vines and branches and grapes and Pharaoh. And it's kind of a really confusing dream. But Joseph hears the dream and then says, I have some good news for you. Here's what your dream means. And then he goes on to explain about how in 3 days, Pharaoh will raise the butler back up to his position. He will restore the butler to his position in just 3 days. In fact, here's how the writer of Genesis says it specifically. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift you up and restore you to your position as his chief cupbearer. So, things are looking up for the cupbearer, who is also the butler by another name. Things are looking good for him. But notice that at this point, nothing has changed for Joseph. Joseph is no closer to getting out of prison than he was before he interpreted the dream of the butler. And here's something that we learn about Joseph in this moment. Something that we learn about Joseph that my guess is many of us can relate to. Joseph doesn't like his circumstances. He doesn't like being in prison. He wants his circumstances to change. He wants his circumstances to be better. And so, having interpreted the butler's dream, he reveals the unhappiness of his circumstances. And he says to the butler, "And please remember me and do me a favor when things go well for you. Mention me to Pharaoh so he might let me out of this place." Having been wrongly accused and unjustly and unfairly imprisoned, Joseph feels the reality of his circumstances. And my guess is he doesn't feel just the reality of the current circumstances of being in prison. My guess is he feels the reality and the weight of having been thrown into a pit by his brothers and left for dead, or listening to the discussion about whether they would just kill him themselves. He feels the weight of having been sold into slavery. And he feels the weight of having been pursued by the Egyptian ruler's wife by the name of, his name was Potiphar, and I just always call her Mrs. Potiphar because we don't know. But Mrs. Potiphar had relentlessly pursued him and then wrongly accused him when he steadfastly resisted her advances. And I have to think, in this moment, when Joseph asks the cupbearer to do a favor and mention him to Pharaoh so that Pharaoh can get him out of this place, that he's feeling the weight of all of that. And he just wants things to be better. Well, in the meantime, the baker is hearing all of this and says, "Hey, don't forget about my dream. I had a dream too, and I kind of like what you said to the butler, so don't forget about me." And so the baker tells Joseph about his dream. He talks to him about baskets and pastries and birds, and it's no wonder nobody could interpret the dream without the help of God like Joseph. And so Joseph says, basically, though it was good news for the butler, the dream for the baker isn't such good news. In fact, here's what he tells him that the dream means. 3 days from now, Pharaoh will lift you up and impale your body on a pole. Then birds will come and peck away at your flesh. Very different interpretations of dreams. One contained good news and one contained bad news. But for Joseph, each of the interpretations came as a result of what God revealed to him, because he chose to believe that God was with him no matter what circumstances he experienced. Well, as it happens, 3 days later is Pharaoh's birthday, and he organizes this grand banquet. And as part of that grand banquet, he restores the cupbearer, the butler, to his position. And he has the baker put to death, just as Joseph had interpreted both dreams. Now I imagine when word of this reaches Joseph, because he probably saw both of them taken out of the prison. And when word of this reaches Joseph, I have to think that he began to live with a new level of hope, because I imagine that he remembered telling the butler to remember him before Pharaoh. And I have to imagine that every time that the prison door opened, that Joseph wondered if that was the open door to his release from prison. I imagine Joseph had his bags packed and he was ready to go. And every day, this day might be the day that my release from prison comes. Unfortunately, that's not how things work out for Joseph. The writer of Genesis tells us that 2 years go by. Two years go by because, what the writer of Genesis tells us, Pharaoh's chief cupbearer, however, forgot all about Joseph, never giving him another thought. So just when Joseph thought things were going to be better, then they're not. Just when Joseph thought his circumstances were going to change, somebody let him down. And he waited. And he waited. And maybe at this point in the story, there's an intersection between Joseph's story and those of people like me and people like you. Because maybe things haven't worked out like you thought. And maybe somebody's let you down. And maybe you've waited for things to get better and they haven't gotten better. And maybe you've waited 2 years. Maybe you've waited longer. Maybe you've waited less, but it seems like longer. And maybe you've lived with hope because you've expected something different than you experience. But through it all, Joseph chose to believe that God was with him. And I wonder, even though it's incredibly challenging, how radically different our responsibility would be if we could choose to believe that God was with us even when it seemed he wasn't. So, 2 years go by. The butler has forgotten all about Joseph and his interpretation of his dreams, and Joseph has remained in prison. And then Pharaoh has some dreams. And the dreams that Pharaoh has, nobody can interpret. He's called all the wise men in and all the magicians in, and nobody can interpret the dreams for Pharaoh. And then the butler remembers Joseph. And he tells Pharaoh about Joseph. And Pharaoh summons for Joseph to be brought in. So he's all cleaned up and brought before the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says, hey, I've heard all about your ability to interpret dreams. And I have some dreams I'd like for you to interpret. And then Joseph says something which again places God at the center of his story. He says to Pharaoh, it is beyond my power to do this. But God can tell you what it means and set you at ease. So Pharaoh begins to tell Joseph about his dreams. He tells him dreams about seven healthy cows that are eaten by seven skinny cows, and seven healthy ears of grain that are eaten, consumed by seven skinny ears of grain. Or it might be flipped that seven skinny and seven healthy. But anyway, the reality is that Joseph hears this story and says, I can tell you what the dreams mean. In Egypt, there's going to be 7 years of abundance, followed by 7 years of famine. And in fact, the 7 years of famine are going to be so intense that everyone will forget about the 7 years of abundance. And then Joseph begins to introduce a plan to Pharaoh about how the 7 years of abundance should be managed to ease the 7 years of famine. Joseph tells him that somebody should be put in charge of storing up food during the 7 years of abundance so that when the famine hits, there's food that's ready and available. And Pharaoh says that this seems like a pretty good idea. Excuse me again. This seems like a pretty good idea. And so Pharaoh begins to put the weight of his leadership behind Joseph's plan. In fact, he puts Joseph in charge of the plan. So Joseph finally gets out of prison and is then put in charge of this 7 years of abundance plan. And here's how the writer of Genesis records this. The Pharaoh, talking to Joseph, says, since God has revealed the meaning of the dreams to you clearly, no one else is as intelligent or wise as you are. You will be in charge of my court, and all my people will take orders from you. Only I, sitting on the throne, will have a rank higher than yours. Finally, things seem to be looking up for Joseph again. Finally, things seem to be turning the corner circumstantially. And I kind of wonder if maybe Joseph didn't feel a little bit hesitant. Like maybe he said, yeah, I've kind of heard this before. Potiphar told me the same thing, and look where that landed me. The prison warden told me the same thing, and I still stayed there longer than I should have. But then Pharaoh gives Joseph a little bit of reassurance when he tells him, I hereby put you in charge of the entire land of Egypt. So Joseph, now established as probably the second most powerful man on the planet, gets to work. He starts storing up grain in the 7 years of abundance. And he builds storehouses all over the land of Egypt to store grain in. And so that when the 7 years of abundance hit, there would be food. And the writer of Genesis tells us that he didn't just store up a little bit of grain. He stored up a ton of grain. In fact, it says, he piled up huge amounts of grain like sand on the seashore. Finally, he stopped keeping records because there was too much to measure. So during the 7 years of abundance, there's an enormous amount of food that is stored up. And after the 7 years of abundance, just as Joseph predicted in the dream, the famine hits. And when the famine hits, there is food that is able to be stored. And Joseph begins to sell the food to the people of Egypt on behalf of Pharaoh. Now, this famine doesn't just stay isolated to the area of Egypt. It begins to spread to the surrounding countries. And it eventually hits the country. It eventually hits the land where Jacob's family lives, including his brothers, who had sold him into slavery. And when the famine reaches there, the writer of Genesis tells us that news of the abundance of food in Egypt reaches Joseph's dad's ears. And so Jacob looks around at the brothers and says this to them. It says, when Jacob heard that grain was available in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why are you standing around looking at one another? I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy enough grain to keep us alive. Otherwise, we'll die." So Jacob sends 10 of the 11 brothers of Joseph to Egypt. And the stage is set for what might be Joseph's greatest responsibility test yet. Yeah, he's had a lot of them so far in his roller coaster life, but now may be the greatest responsibility test that he faces. His brothers come to Egypt, and they come seeking food in the midst of a famine. And interestingly enough, they have to come and seek food from Joseph, the very brother they sold into slavery, the very brother they threw into a pit and then went and ate lunch and talked about whether they were going to let him die or kill him themselves, the very brother they didn't want to take the effort to put a cover-up plan in place to tell their dad what had happened to him. So they come, and it says that when they arrived, they bowed down before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph recognized his brothers instantly, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. I imagine this moment was almost overwhelming to Joseph. He recognizes his brothers, and he remembers the moment that they grabbed him and threw him into a pit. He remembers being in that pit and listening to their conversation of hate toward him, deciding whether to leave him in the pit to die on his own or to kill him themselves. And then he remembers one of his brothers, Judah, saying, "Hey, off in the distance I see a caravan of slave traders coming. Let's not kill him. Let's sell him. Let's at least profit from selling him." And then he remembers being taken away by the slave traders and put on the auction block and sold to Potiphar. And then he remembers Mrs. Potiphar falsely accusing him and him being put in prison. And then he remembers the butler forgetting about him. And he stands there face to face with his brothers, remembering all of this. And in that moment, he has a decision to make. And he looks at his brothers and he says three words to them. He says, "I am Joseph." And his brothers wet themselves. Actually, I just made that part up. It's not in the story. But I wonder how his brothers responded. I wonder what they thought in that moment. Because my guess is it was their time to remember. It was their time to remember what they had done to Joseph. And it was their time to wonder what the rest of Joseph's life had been between now and then. And it was their time to feel the angst and the pain and the anguish of their decision to do what they did to Joseph. And it was their moment to wonder if retribution wasn't coming in full force. And before they can say anything, Joseph says once again, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" In this moment, where Joseph could have done anything and said anything to them, His primary concern is the relationship of love for him and his dad. And the writer of Genesis tells us how the brothers respond. But his brothers were speechless. They were stunned to realize that Joseph was standing there in front of them. Some other translations replace the word stunned with the word terrified. And if his brothers are terrified, it's probably rightly deserved. And there's a part of me that I'm glad they're terrified. They should be terrified. And in that moment, Joseph has the opportunity to react or to respond. And Joseph looks at his brothers and he says, "Please come closer. I am Joseph, your brother whom you sold into slavery in Egypt." This is the third time that Joseph has said, "I am Joseph." The first time, just, "I am Joseph." The second time, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" And then the third time, "I am Joseph, your brother, the one whom you sold into slavery." And I wonder, after Joseph told them to come closer, I wonder how long it took them to move. And I wonder how long it took them to come closer. I wonder if they just crept their way a little closer, wondering after each step what Joseph would do. And I wonder what they expected. And I wonder what they felt. I have to believe that in that moment, all of the years of apathy of Joseph came flooding back in being terrified. Well, Joseph does a little back and forth with them. And it takes up about almost three chapters in Genesis. But he tells them to go home. And he tells them to gather up their families and all their belongings and their father Jacob and bring everything and everyone to Egypt. And that they can live in Egypt with Joseph. And Joseph will make sure that they have everything they need, that they will be taken care of. And so his brothers go back, they gather everything up, and they come back. And they're still a little bit apprehensive about this whole dynamic. Their father Jacob dies. And they wonder if now that Jacob's gone, if this won't be the time when Joseph enacts his retribution and revenge. And so they come up with a little bit of a scheme to try to manipulate Joseph to thinking that Jacob wanted to make sure they were not treated unfairly or that they were forgiven by Joseph for all the bad things they had done to him. And as they divulge this plan, Joseph responds to them this way. "But don't be upset, and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives." When we choose to believe that God is with us, we can obtain a different perspective on our circumstances. We can discover that our circumstances don't have to have the last word in what we believe about God and what we hope for in life. We can come to believe that circumstances are only a part of the story, and that God is in the story doing something for us, to do something in us, to do something through us. Joseph was able to say, don't be upset with yourselves. You sold me into slavery, but it was God who brought me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. God put me in a position to do something for you, even after everything that you had done for me. So how do his brothers respond? It says, then his brothers came and threw themselves down before Joseph. Look, we are your slaves. I find it fascinating that the brothers who sold Joseph into slavery now come to him and say that they are his slaves. I find it fascinating the turn of events and the reversal of roles that takes place in this. And then Joseph responds to them. Don't be afraid of me. Am I God that I can punish you? You intended to harm me, but God intended it all for good. Joseph refuses to accept the role or responsibility of God. He chooses responsibility instead of repaying evil for evil. He chooses to forgive rather than to seek retribution or to really even seek justice. He chooses to respond because he believes that God has been with him and continues to be with him through all the highs and through all the lows. In the pit, God was with him. In slavery, God was with him. In prison, God was with him. When he was set up in command of Potiphar's house, God was with him. When he was put in charge of the prison, God was with him. When he was brought before Pharaoh and put in charge of Egypt and became the second most powerful man on earth. When it appeared that Pharaoh was his only hope, he had put his hope in God. He chose to believe that God was with him even when it seemed that it wasn't, that he wasn't. And he says, what you intended for harm, you intended to harm me, but God intended it all for good. So no matter what it is, no matter what circumstances he faced, no matter what circumstances you face, no matter what circumstances I face, God intends it for good. Not that it's pleasant, not that it's desirable. Not that we don't want it to change, just like Joseph wanted his circumstances to change. Not that we want to go through it, not that we don't want it to stop. But whatever it is, God is working in it to do something for us, to do something in us, to do something through us. God is using this circumstance, whatever it is, positive, negative, something in between. God is using this circumstance to position you to believe that he is with you. And he is using this circumstance to position you to help and to serve and to make something better for someone else as something better happens for you. So here's the question. How would someone in your circumstances respond if they believed God was with them? Our answer to that question is an invitation to respondability. It is an invitation to navigate life, to manage every circumstance, as if circumstances don't have the last word in what we believe about God, but to believe that our circumstances are only part of the story, and that God is in the story, and God intends it for good, to do something in us, to do something through us. Our answer is respondability. And when we choose respondability, we will be better for it. The people around us will be better for it. And maybe, just maybe, the world will be better for it. Circumstances rarely, if ever, are the full and complete story, because God is at work in every circumstance. And because God is at work in every circumstance, we can be better for it, no matter what it is. Let me pray as we wrap up this time together. Dear God, thank you for the story of a guy like Joseph. Thank you for his story through which we can discover that you are at work in the midst of every circumstance, the positive, the negative, the neutral, and that you intend for every circumstance to be something where the work that you desire to do for us, in us, and through us can be accomplished. And God, may each and every one of us that's connected in this message today discover how to choose the path of respondability. And God, for me, thank you for the places in my life where I've been able to choose respondability well. And God, for those areas where I don't do as well in choosing respondability, help give me the wisdom, the thoughtfulness, and the heart to choose to respond rather than react. And through it all, help me, help us to choose to believe that you are with us, even when it may seem like you're not. Pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, thank you for choosing to connect with us for this final installment of the Better For It series. As we wrap up this series, I hope that this isn't your last time choosing to connect with us, but I do hope that this time helped you to grow in relationship with God and as a follower of Jesus.
Thanks again for tuning in, and we hope this message helped you take a step in your relationship with God. If you're considering other ways to connect, check out HCC's website, social media, and YouTube channels.